Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
We are in Hosea 5 tonight. Last week, looking at Hosea 4, we saw God laying out his case against Israel and really focusing on, really concentrating on the priests, even though he did mention the prophets as well. In chapter 5, he's going to start by mentioning the priests again, but then he's going to widen his gaze and include all the people of Israel, including the kings. And he's going to demonstrate how all of them are guilty. And that's really chapter 5 and chapter 6. But look at the very last verse of chapter 5. It says, "I will go away and return to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face, and in their affliction they will earnestly seek me." That is what we have seen repeatedly, again, going all the way back to Deuteronomy 30, that in the place where they are scattered, that's where they're going to turn and look for their God again. Look at the end of chapter 6, the very last verse. "O Judah, there is a harvest appointed for you when I restore the fortunes of my people." So this is the theme again all the way through Hosea, that first God lays out their absolute guilt, demonstrates to them why it is that he is punishing them, why it is that he is scattering them, why they are in particular going into the Assyrian captivity, later Judah going into the Babylonian captivity. They certainly deserve it, but at no point does God ever turn away from the covenant promises that he has made to this particular people group. And even each chapter finishes with promises of restoration, of regathering again. And that is what we see consistently from all of the prophets. So chapter 5 starts with God declaring his case against Israel. "Hear this, O priests, give heed, O house of Israel." So it's not just your priests and your leaders that are at fault. It's all of you people, because you've been chasing after your foreign gods. "Listen, O house of the king." So from the very highest to the very lowest of the people in Israel, God is saying, you are all guilty before me. "For the judgment applies to all of you. For you," Israel again, the northern tribe in particular, he's going to compare Ephraim and Israel by the time we get to verse 3. He's talking to that northern tribe, and that's why he can say, or to those northern tribes, and that's why he can say, "You have become a snare in Mizpah and a net spread out on Tabor." Whether we're talking about a net or a snare, it is a way of trapping people. It's a way of capturing people. And Mizpah and Tabor were the primary cities in the north where that cultic worship of foreign gods was going on. And so here God is saying that as you journey to those high places in order to worship those gods, that is all acting as a trap, as a snare, as a net to you, to demonstrate how guilty you are before me. And then he says the revolters, those who are in rebellion against him, have gone deep into depravity, and I will chastise all of them. So whether we're talking about the kings, whether we're talking about the priests, whether we're talking about the prophets, whether we're talking about the people, anybody who is engaged in this rebellion against God that he likens to an adultery all the way through the prophets, that Israel, as an erring wife, has sold herself into an adultery, and one of the most foolish forms of adultery, she has sold herself into prostitution and made no gain from it, made no money from it. So not only is it a rebellion against God, but it's a foolish rebellion. They're getting nothing out of it. Here he says, you've trapped yourself, you've cornered yourself, you've sprung on yourself like a net because you've gone to Mizpah, you've gone to Tabor, and you have worshiped these other gods. And then he says, those who do that, the rebels who do that, are deep in their depravity, and that's why I will punish them. That's why I will chastise them. So they're fully at fault, unquestionably, which is why I began by reading the very last verse of this chapter, because it is truly astounding to see the faithfulness, the trustworthiness, and the grace of God that can point out how bad these people are. Repeatedly say to them, you are as depraved as they come. You are rebels against me. You have trapped yourself. You are nothing but guilty, and I made you a promise. Aren't you glad for that? Because I see myself in that rebellious category. I can find myself very easily in the category of people who have tripped themselves up. And yet the grace of God has reached out to save even a wretch like me, not because of me, but because of promises he has already made, covenants he has already made through his Son. Well, here, the promise was the Abrahamic promise. The Abrahamic covenant is that they are going to be gathered. They are going to live in their land in perpetuity. They are going to be at peace. And as he keeps saying repeatedly, I will be their God and they will be my people. So that has to happen. And yet God is making sure they know that they are completely guilty and therefore they are going to worship and celebrate him based on his grace and his goodness and not on anything they have done, which is why Paul in the New Testament would say that God has held everybody under sin, Jew or Gentile, so that he can have mercy on all, so that all who are saved, all who end up in his presence, end up there as a result of the kind of God he is and not because of the kind of people we've become. Verse 3, I know Ephraim. That's kind of a frightening statement to me because he says, I know everything about you. I know. This is why we say that God is omnipresent and omniscient on top of being all-powerful. Doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what your sin is, your rebellion. It doesn't matter what your particular trespass and proclivities are. He knows. And here he is talking about very, very guilty, adulterous Ephraim. And he says, and I know Ephraim. Now, if this is one of those instances where he is saying, I have relationship with them, unlike the relationship that I have with any other people group, then this also explains why it is that at the end of the chapter, he's going to say, but they're going to be restored. Because even in their rebellion, even in their adultery, he still says, I know them on a level of intimacy that can't be broken. I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hidden from me. That is why I'm reading it as, I know what you're up to. I know what you're doing. Because the second half of the sentence is, Israel's not hidden from me. They may think that when they go into their foreign temples or when they worship their gods in the dark, they may think that maybe I don't see it or I don't know. But I see it all. I see Ephraim. I know Ephraim. Israel is not hidden from me. For now, O Ephraim, you have played the harlot. I've seen it. I've watched you do it, and you're guilty. And Israel has defiled itself. Their deeds will not allow them to return to their God. It's very interesting language because he's saying, your deeds, your guilt, the way you have chased after other gods is going to make it impossible for you then to come back to me and worship me too. We're going to see demonstrations of that as we continue tonight. This was a very common practice, apparently, in ancient Israel. Not only would they worship their foreign gods, that activity, but then during the feast days and during the new moons, they would bring their animals, they'd go to Jerusalem as they were required to do by the law. They would go and sacrifice to Yahweh, and he's going to say in a minute that he's tired of it. He's tired of their sacrifices because of the hypocrisy with which they are worshiping him while worshiping other gods. Because what's the first of the big Ten Commandments? You'll have no other gods before me. And this is exactly what they are guilty of. And so your deeds will not allow them to return to their God. For a spirit of harlotry is within them. It is their nature, it's their character to rebel against their God. That is their very spirit. It's in the core of who they are that they are rebellious by nature and they chase other gods by nature and they will not be singular toward their God, Yahweh. And the spirit of harlotry is within them and they do not know Yahweh. So even though Yahweh is the God of Israel, and even though the God of Israel says, I know you, he also says, but you don't know me. Now that, by the way, is very similar to the language that Jesus himself uses in the New Testament when he says there are going to be people who are going to say, Lord, Lord, haven't we done? And they're going to talk about the things that they have accomplished in his name. And he's going to say, depart from me, you workers of iniquity. I never knew you. So just because you claim to know God and may bring your animals, he's going to call them whole flocks and herds that you bring to Jerusalem that he's tired of, even though you may come and worship me in my temple, you don't know me, but I know you. And I know you have this spirit of rebellion and harlotry within you. The spirit of harlotry is within them, and they do not know Yahweh. Moreover, the pride of Israel testifies against him. So what's that most often cited sin in the Bible?
Pride.
Pride. One person was right there with it. And he's proud that he was. That he's the only one who knew at that moment. Yeah, because here Israel, the reason that they think they can get away with worshiping these other gods and then going to Jerusalem to pacify Yahweh, their God, as well, is because in their ego, in their pride, they think that they can get away with it. And yet, God says, I know you. I know you intimately. I know what you're doing. You're not hidden from me. And I see right through the hypocrisy of your pride. Moreover, the pride of Israel testifies against him, and Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. That word stumble in the Hebrew does mean to fall, to collapse. And you're doing that right in front of me because of your iniquity. Again, this is God laying out his case, proving that they are guilty. And then he adds, and Judah also has stumbled with them. However, he is going to continue to make that distinction between Israel and Judah, because as the Assyrian army invades the northern tribes and takes them into captivity, the Assyrian armies get all the way to the walls of Jerusalem. And then God, via an angel, a death angel that comes in the night and wipes out the armies, he protects Jerusalem because Jerusalem needs to remain intact and then go into the Babylonian captivity. He has a different plan for them, but they are also guilty. Now, the book of Ezekiel tells us why it is that Judah is so guilty, and in fact, in some ways, more guilty than Israel. Ezekiel refers to them as two erring sisters who came out of Egypt. And he calls them Ahola and Aholibah from the beginning, these two sisters who rebel against God. And he says that Israel is in rebellion and going to be driven out of their land. And the erring sister Judah saw that. They saw the punishment of God. They saw the righteousness of God on display and didn't change their ways. And therefore, they are even more guilty because they had the demonstration right in front of them. So here God says it's not just Israel and Ephraim, but Judah also has stumbled with them. Verse 6, I think, is God being a little sarcastic. The reason I think that is because the language is mocking the fact that they are coming to Jerusalem with their sacrifices. And he says, they will go with their flocks and their herds. They'll just keep bringing animals to me. They'll keep slaying animals like that's going to pacify me. Because the next phrase is, they bring their flocks and their herds to seek Yahweh, but they will not find him. So he is mocking them for their religious ceremonies, for the fact that they are doing the stuff the law requires of them in terms of worship of Yahweh at Jerusalem, but then they come and think that that is going to make things right between them and God. And as they are seeking him through all of their sacrifices, he says, you're not going to find me. I will stand away from you. I'm in the business of punishing you right now. So they will go with their flocks and their herds to seek the Lord, but they will not find him because he has withdrawn from them. They have dealt treacherously against Yahweh, for they have borne illegitimate children. He is saying that as they have continued in their idol worship, they have passed it down generation to generation, thereby bearing these illegitimate children. And now the new moon, one of the reasons why they go to Jerusalem, one of the reasons that they bring their flocks and their herds, one of the reasons they go to the temple is keeping their new moons and their Sabbaths. And yet God says, as they're keeping those new moons, it will devour them in their own land. It'll just make them more and more guilty, because as they come in their hypocrisy and they sacrifice to Yahweh, they are demonstrating, we know that you're the God of Israel, but we also are really dedicated to these gods over here that belong to these foreign nations. So we want the best of both worlds. We want to sacrifice to those gods and to you. And God says, each time you come, each time you celebrate your new moon, each time you slay an animal, you are just demonstrating that you are guiltier and guiltier. It is devouring you. Which hypocrisy, by the way, does to people. Blow the horn in Gibeah, and the trumpet at Ramah, sound an alarm at Beth Avon, and then the phrase, behind you, Benjamin. Now, you can read many commentaries about that passage. It's relatively cryptic, but we do know where these different cities are. Gibeah and Ramah are just north of Jerusalem, actually in the area of Benjamin, right up along the border where Benjamin and the northern kingdom have their borders against each other. So we're talking about the northernmost cities of Judah that are almost over the border into Israel, into Ephraim, the northern tribes. But then Beth Avon, which we identified last week as meaning the house of wickedness, the house of rebellion and sinfulness, that is probably a reference to the city that is right over the border, which is Bethel, used to be called the house of God. And God is calling it, sarcastically here, the house of wickedness. It's not the house of Yahweh anymore. So what he's describing are cities that are right along the border of the northern and the southern kingdom and the very north of Benjamin, so that when the Assyrian armies do come down on the northern tribes and keep heading southward, they're coming toward Benjamin, and therefore, look out, Benjamin. Look behind you. Here come the marauding armies who, I told you, make it all the way to Jerusalem before they're turned back. So Ephraim will become a desolation. Those northern tribes will be taken into captivity, and that land will be occupied by foreign people, no longer by Israelites. Ephraim will become a desolation in that day of rebuke. And among the tribes of Israel, I declare what is certain. I appreciate it and also kind of scratch my head at how often God has to say, and I mean it. This will happen. I mean, after all, he is the sovereign God of everything. But every once in a while, just to drive home the point, he has to say, and this is definitely going to happen because I said so. And so Israel, the northern tribes, are going to become a desolation. And among the tribes of Israel, I declare what is sure. And the princes of Judah have become like those who move a boundary. There is a very specific law in the Deuteronomical law that says that you cannot move a boundary stone, because God laid out all the land and what tribes got that land and then what families got the land within those tribal areas. And they were marked by stones. And if you were a person who wanted to get a little bit of extra land, you would go out at night and you would move the boundary stones. And there's even a law against doing that. It is a form of chicanery. It is a form of thievery. And he says, the kings of Judah, the princes, the leaders in Judah have become like those who sneak out into the night and steal from other people. So he's demonstrating that Judah is also guilty. They've become like those who move a boundary. And on them, I will pour out my wrath like water. So he does eventually do that when he takes them into the Babylonian captivity, after giving them prophet after prophet after prophet who warns them that it's coming, and they don't change their ways, and they even have the demonstration of seeing their brethren from the north be taken into the Assyrian captivity, and yet they will also continue to rebel and to chase their foreign gods. Ephraim, the northern tribes, is oppressed and crushed in judgment, because he was determined to follow man's command. When Solomon was told that God was going to separate his kingdom, but that for David's sake, he was going to leave him two of the tribes, but the northern tribes were going to have a different king. And then God said, I won't do it during your days, but I'm going to do it in your son's days. So then Rehoboam, his son, comes along. Jeroboam becomes the king of the northern tribes, and he doesn't want to see the northern tribes continue to go to Jerusalem, because he is afraid that that will encourage them to politically reconnect with their brethren in the south. And so he starts laying up new places of worship in the high places and in the hills, and he encourages them to worship these foreign gods. Okay, those are all ideas of a man. Those are all commands from a man. And yet there are these commands from God that say, you won't make a graven image. There are these commands that say, remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. There are these commands that say, you'll have no other god. And yet, rather than listen to what Yahweh has commanded of them, they listen to the commands of other men. And you know that whenever men are making up their rules and commands, their ego, their pride gets involved, and they want to tell you the kind of stuff that will attract you to them. And so they'll tell you things like, you're doing great, and come be part of our group and you'll be accepted. And don't worry about all that stuff that God said. I mean, that's too hard. We'll go easier on you. Just bring your worship to these other gods and they'll give you rain and they'll give you food just like Yahweh did. You're going to be fine. And the people listened to that rather than listening to the word of God. Does that sound familiar at all? Seems to be going on to this day. So Ephraim is oppressed and crushed in judgment because he was determined to follow man's command. And therefore, I'm like a moth to Ephraim. Moths were a very big deal when they were living in houses that had open windows and stuff. If a moth came in and started eating through your clothes, you've got like one set of clothing, maybe a cloak. He said, I'll be like that. I'll just come in and just start destroying stuff. And I will be like rottenness in the house of Judah. That word, rottenness, the Hebrew word, is talking about a rot in their bones. He's saying, I will be so destructive to them that I will weaken them and I'll weaken their stuff. I'll be a destroyer to them. When Ephraim saw his sickness, when Ephraim realizes it's going bad for them and that they're about to go into the captivity of the Assyrians, when Judah saw his wound, then what do? They should go to Yahweh. They should go to their God. They should pray for deliverance because there is this whole history where when they did that, God delivered them. It's what they should have done, but they didn't. Instead, when Judah and Ephraim saw their sickness and their wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to King Jareb. In other words, they tried to make peace pacts. They tried to make deals. And that had been going on for a long time there in the northern kingdom, going all the way back to Tiglath-Pileser III. I'm surprised that there were two previous Tiglath-Pilesers. But those were the Assyrian kings that actually made the northern tribes into a vassal state where they were paying tribute to the Assyrian king, just trying to get the Assyrians not to attack them so that they could remain an independent kingdom. Well, God even holds that against them. It says, when you realized your sickness, when you saw how bad it was going for you, when you should have come to me, you went to another man. You went to a foreign king. You started cutting deals. You can hear God saying, what are you thinking? I'm right here. I'm the one that put you in this land. I can give you the land of milk and honey. I can protect you from your enemies. I can protect you from the wild animals. I can do all that, and yet you keep making deals with these foreigners, worshiping their foreign gods, because you think that's how you make peace. And yet he is unable to heal you. And he is unable to cure you of your wound. Because when it is God who wounds you, when it is God who is being a moth, when it is God who is being rottenness in your bones, there's no man that can fix that. When you have the Almighty working against you, there are no men who are going to be able to cure you or solve your problem. You have to go back to the one who is causing the problem. That just seems logical. You would have to go to the God that is causing your rottenness in order to be cured of your rottenness. But not only when they go to the Assyrians and make a deal does that not heal them, it actually ends up destroying them. Because those armies do, in fact, come down on Israel and do, in fact, take them into captivity that they still have not recovered from. That sickness is still going on. That wound is still in them to this very day because they keep looking for human cures. For I will be like a lion to Ephraim, and like a young lion to the house of Judah, We don't feel that as much today because most of our encounters with lions are in zoos or circuses. But if you were traveling in the Middle East and a lion was in your path, you were in trouble. Especially if it's a young lion who's hungry and who can outrun you and who sees you as lunch. And so this is a way of God saying that he is going to be frightening to them. I will be like a lion to Ephraim, like a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will tear them to pieces and go away. I will carry away, and there will be none to deliver. And that's exactly what he did. He did carry away the northern tribes into the Assyrian captivity, just like he said he was going to do. I will go away, and I will return to my place. Notice God's like, you know, it's going to go really bad for you. I'll still be here in heaven. I'll still be on my throne doing whatever pleases me. I'll be fine. You're the ones who are going to be damaged by this. Why are you going to act like this? I will return to my place. I'll go away. Until, and I love that word until, because that means this is not permanent. It means there is a time when the cure is coming. Until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face, and then the guarantee that that will happen, in their affliction, they will earnestly seek me. Now, this is the exact same God who a moment ago had to point out, I am going to do this. And so this is the same God who said, in their affliction, they will earnestly seek me. So will they eventually, in their affliction, chase after their God again? Well, yes, that's what all the prophets say. They will seek him again in the very places where God has scattered them. And he is going to draw them again. So again, Hosea isn't saying anything unique. He is saying the same thing that all the prophets speak with one voice, that God is going to scatter them, he's going to punish them, but because of the covenants and promises he has made to the fathers, he is going to restore them, he's going to regather them. And they will seek him, and they will be his people, and he will be their God. That's going to happen. But then in chapter 6, the first few verses make it sound like this is the language of their repentance. And it would be easy to read it that way because they say, come, let us return to the Lord. So it's easy to think, well, now he's quoting what they're going to say when they're in their affliction, when they earnestly seek me. But as you're going to see in a moment, this is not the case. Instead, this is a demonstration of their hypocrisy in the way that they try to seek Yahweh and God will not accept it. Come, let us return to Yahweh, for he has torn us, but he will heal us. He has wounded us, but he will bandage us. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day. That's just language of, it's going to happen quickly. Sometimes I've seen commentators try to tie that into Christ being raised on the third day. I think that's a little bit of a stretch, a little bit of a leap. Instead, that is a Hebraism, after 2 days, even three. That means it's going to happen quickly. So let us know. Let us press on to know Yahweh. His going forth is as certain as the dawn, and he will come to us like the rain, like the spring rain watering the earth. Now that all sounds like great language. That sounds like the return of Israel back to their God, and they are finally admitting that he is their God, and he's the one that tore us, and he's the one that's healing us, except for God's response to it. God's response to it demonstrates that what this really is them showing how hypocritical they are, where when they are desperate, when they are hurting, they say all these grand things about Yahweh, but they're not doing it with their whole heart. and they're still continuing to commit their harlotries and chase after other gods. So that's the language of Ephraim talking to God, but look at verse 4. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? It's not God saying, oh, good, you've returned to me. He's saying, what is your problem? What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? For your loyalty is like a morning cloud. That means it just dissipates. It just disappears. Sure, you look loyal to me when it benefits you. Sure, when I'm hurting you, sure, you turn to me. But then your loyalty is like a morning cloud, like the dew which goes away early. And we all know that. We all see those examples. You see dew on the ground, and an hour later it's gone. And that's what God is saying. Your loyalty to me is so fleeting that you'll say words to me, and then as soon as everything's okay again, then you'll chase your gods again. But that is the history of Israel. As we've read all of the historic books about Israel and their wanderings and their Egyptian captivity and then going 40 years in the desert and then the early days of them being in their land, they are constantly rebelling against God, so God has to bring down their enemies on them. And then when they are afflicted enough, they cry out to God. God delivers them. Sometimes he sends them a hero like a Samson. Sends them judges, sends them warrior kings, sends them David. He delivers them, and then as soon as they get comfortable again, they immediately turn back to their erring ways. That's the whole history of Israel. And so you can see God saying here, your loyalty is like a morning cloud, like the dew that just goes away early. And therefore, I have hewn them in pieces by the prophets. Here's God testifying about his own prophets. And he said, I've been sending you prophets who are telling you the truth, who are telling you about your own guilt, who are telling you that I'm going to punish you. And every time you reject what my prophets are telling you, I'm just ripping you apart. I'm demonstrating how guilty you are. I'm showing you your own rebellion against me by the very fact that I have sent you prophets. They have told you the truth. And as Jesus said, which of the prophets did you not kill? They rejected the prophets wholesale. Therefore, I have torn them into pieces by the prophets. And then look at the language here. I have slain them by the words of my mouth. How did he do that? Through his prophets. The God who keeps saying, I mean what I say, also sent prophets to say what God said. And God says, those are my words. The prophets are speaking it, but I put those words in their mouth. And yet, you wouldn't listen. You wouldn't respond. And therefore, you are slain. I have torn you apart. I have torn you into pieces by the prophets. I have slain them by the words of my mouth. And the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. In other words, God, who is the light that pierces the darkness, that same ability to demonstrate himself against all darkness, against all evil, that same ability to demonstrate himself is going to be how he's going to judge. His judgments are a demonstration of who he is, and it's unavoidable when he shows who he is. For I delight in loyalty. Now, a moment ago, he said, your loyalty is like the morning cloud. Your loyalty dissipates immediately. But I delight in actual loyalty. So much so that I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice. You think that you're satisfying me, that you're worshiping me by your flocks and your herds that you're bringing to Jerusalem on your new moons and on your Sabbaths and on your feast days, and you keep doing that thinking that that is satisfying the requirements that I've put on you. And yet, I would rather have your loyalty than your sacrifices. Because your sacrifices are just a physical thing you're doing and your heart's not in it. You don't even understand the purpose for doing it. You're not truly worshiping me. You're just killing animals. I'd rather you be loyal to me. And in the knowledge of God, I'd rather that you have that. I delight in that. I delight in the knowledge of God rather than in burnt offerings. So I think big picture here, God speaking to Israel says, mockingly, you bring your herds, you bring your flocks, you think that's accomplishing some kind of appeasement toward me. But then he says, I prefer loyalty and I prefer the knowledge of God rather than the traditions of religion. And I think we could apply that to this very day, that this is the same God who is still on his throne to this very day. He expects your heart more than he expects that you do religious performance. There is a whole wing of modern religion that is all performance-based. And here God says, I'd rather have your loyalty. I'd rather have your heart. I'd rather you have the knowledge of me and who I am more than the performance of religious standards. I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Now I need to take a moment, and good, I've left myself enough time that I can do this. Verse 7 has been used acontextually by the covenantalist crowd. Do you know what I mean when I say covenantalists? Covenantalists posit that there was a covenant made in the Garden of Eden, a covenant between Adam and God. They call that the Old Covenant. And then everything beyond that comes under the heading of the Covenant of Grace. And they say there are different administrations of that one and the same covenant of grace, despite the fact that the Bible never says that God made a covenant with Adam on par with how he made a covenant with Noah or with Abraham or with Israel at Mount Sinai. But it is what they call a theological necessity in order for their system to work. And they will point here at Hosea 6:7 because it does say, but like Adam, they have transgressed the covenant. Now, in the NASB, they've even capitalized Adam, which you know wasn't in the original language, so that they can say that like Adam, Israel transgressed the covenant so that they can say there had to be a covenant with Adam in order for Adam to transgress it. Except that the Hebrew word Adam means man. That's why the first man was called Adam. And of course, it is not a proper name as much as it is a description of that particular creature. And so, all the way back to the King James, this is one of those places where I think the King James did a better job of translating than even the NASB does. I like the NASB, but every once in a while you gotta compare, you gotta contrast the different translations. King James says, but like men, they have transgressed the covenant, because that's exactly what he is getting at. That while Israel felt that they weren't like the other nations, the other Gentiles, they weren't like standard men, they were the chosen people, they were the elect of God, they were the beloved, they were the wife of God, and yet they were under a covenant, that covenant of law that came to them from Mount Sinai through Moses. And the same way that men, all men, are incapable of keeping their end of any covenant agreement with God, which is why God has to make unconditional covenants like the one that he made with Abraham or like the one he made through Christ, the new covenant. When he made a conditional covenant like the law covenant, men just simply couldn't do it. And that was the weakness of the law, like we talked about last night in men's group. the weakness of that first covenant was that men just couldn't do it because of their sinfulness. So in keeping with all of that theology, it seems more obvious to me that rather than inventing a covenant that isn't mentioned anywhere in the Bible, and rather saying, but it's implied in this verse, all you have to do is recognize the ancient Hebrew word, Adam, which has always meant man. It shows up a lot in the Old Testament and usually is not capitalized and called the name of Adam. But in this particular verse, in order to support a system, they capitalized it, made it a proper name, and said, well, see, Adam transgressed the covenant in the Garden of Eden. So instead, what verse 7 says, I insist, and like many translators have properly translated it, for I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and I delight in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. But, like men, they have transgressed the covenant, and they have dealt treacherously with me. That makes much more sense. Gilead is a city of wrongdoers, tracked with bloody footprints. And as raiders wait for a man, so a band of priests murder on the way to Shechem. What's interesting about both Gilead and Shechem is that they are both one of the five cities of refuge that were set up in Israel. And if a man could get into one of those cities of refuge when he was guilty of slaying a man, couldn't be killed for it, as long as he remained in that city of refuge. And here God is demonstrating that Gilead, which was supposed to be a safe place, has become a city of wrongdoers and in fact did later have a reputation of being a place of thieves and crooks and bad men. It is tracked with bloody footprints. They're like raiders, robbers who wait for a man so that they can pounce on him. And a band of priests, the ones who are supposed to be leading people in the ways of God, they murder on their way to the next city of refuge. There's deep evil going on in Israel at this point. And of course, God has said, I know it, I see it. Surely they have committed crime. In the house of Israel, I have seen a horrible thing. Yeah, it was really, truly, genuinely horrible by that point. And by the way, when God, the real God, the holy God, the righteous God, when that God says, I see horrible things, you got to know that that is dark stuff he's referring to. When priests are murdering, pretty bad. When his own people are bringing gifts to temple prostitutes, and producing illegitimate children, pretty dark, pretty bad. And in fact, the word they've committed crime there is actually a word that implies sexual deviancy. They have become as corrupt before God as they can become. And the house of Israel, I have seen a horrible thing. Ephraim's harlotry is there. Israel has defiled itself. Okay, now that is a pretty bad accusation, a pretty bad assessment of what is going on in Israel. If God were to wipe them out completely, if he were to take them into the lands of the Gentiles and scatter them. Whatever he has to do to them, he is well within his rights to do that because they are demonstrated to be evil, wicked people. And yet, verse 11 says, also, O Judah, there is a harvest appointed for you. What? That's your concluding statement? Your concluding statement is, I've seen horrible things, and I see a brighter day ahead. How can that possibly be? You have heard me so many times say, You are your biggest problem, and therefore you cannot be your solution. You can't be your cure when you are your sickness. And so Israel cannot be cured. Israel cannot do anything about the punishment that God is putting on them in their scattered condition, losing their ability to worship God. They can't even get to Jerusalem anymore. They are cut off from him entirely. And yet, somehow, there is this day of restitution. There is this day of harvest coming. There is this day of repopulation coming. And it can't be because of them, because of how guilty they are. You get my point? Mm-hmm. Or am I just ranting and raving because I feel like it? Which I do, by the way. So, oh, Judah, there is a harvest appointed for you. When I restore the fortunes of my people. So, how are Israel in their depravity? He said so. In their rebellion? He said so. In their harlotry? He said so. In their murders and their chasing other gods? He said so. How are they possibly going to be restored to once again being the people of God? Can't be them. Has to be God. And that's why we do read the language that we found in Zechariah. That's why we do find the language all the way back in Deuteronomy 30. That is why we do see that language of God saying, but I will do it. He has to do it. If he doesn't do it, it's not getting done. Right. And yet he keeps saying, I will restore them. I will regather them. In the place where they are scattered, they will return to me. They will come back to their husband. That's the whole example of Hosea, that after his wife returns to her harlotries, that God said, now go get her again and then protect her and keep her from her gods. And so this is everything that God intends to do for Israel. Now, he has not done this for them for 2,700 years now. Hasn't done it. That seems like a long time to us. They've been in that scattered state for a long time. Is that a problem for him?
Nope.
Not a difficulty for him at all? No.
It's a day and a half for him.
Pardon?
It's a day and a half for him.
It's a day and a half. Yeah. If a day with the Lord is 1,000 years, that's an afternoon. He knows where they are. He knows where he scattered them. He knows he plans to gather them. And there's nothing too difficult for the mighty hand of God. And he still, despite their rebellion and despite their adulteries and despite them worshiping other gods, he still calls himself the God of Israel. And when he sends Christ, the first prophet that lifts him up in the temple says, this is the salvation of Israel. The language is very specific. As we were saying last night at men's group, to confuse that, you got to go to school. You got to get an education in theology to mess that up. Because the language is so very specific. God will indeed restore the fortunes of his people. Look at chapter 7, verse 1, and we'll end on this phrase. When I would heal Israel, and the iniquity of Ephraim is uncovered, and the evil deeds of Samaria, for they deal falsely, and the thief enters in, and the bandits raid outside. Verse 11 there is shoehorned in between Ephraim's harlotry and Israel defiling itself. And the iniquity of Ephraim is uncovered and their evil deeds, and they deal falsely, and shoehorned right into the midst of all their sinfulness and guilt is the promise from God that he will restore them. I find that fascinating. Because we, too, are dependent on that very God to be exactly like that. Because while it's easy to point at Israel and say, boy, those silly people, what were they thinking? Worshipping their idols and chasing foreign gods? And what were they thinking? Like we're any better. And so we are told by Christ that we are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind and strength. That's what God expects from us. He's not looking for sacrifices. He's not looking for us to do the practices of religion. He's looking for dedication and faithfulness to him. He's looking for loyalty to him. And he is going to work through his people to get that very thing for himself. And all the glory forever is going to go to him and him alone. And there's going to be no human anywhere who can ever say, I had a part in that. Can you see what God is doing? He's in the process. He's in the enterprise of glorifying himself through wicked, sinful, evil people like Israel and Tom.
Amen.
And that's the God we serve. And that's a wonderful message of grace. Questions, comments, feedback.
For what it's worth, the ESV also capitalizes the A in Adam in verse 7.
Yeah. So. Some of the modern translations do that, and I just don't.
Yeah, there's footnotes though saying it's men.
Yeah, it's men.
Yeah.
Yeah. They footnoted that rather than just put it in the text, because that's what it is. Yeah. Anything else? Well, then I will turn it over to the voice of the guy who does not exist. For the folks on the internet, the guy who introduces us and the guy who closes our program does not exist. He's an AI voice, and every once in a while I just have to admit that so that people on the internet don't think that we think we're fooling them.
Who's so. The new guy?
Who's the new guy?
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.